Courts of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome today several students. We have students from Platteville High School. Would they please stand? Good morning. You had to get up pretty early to get here today. You may be seated. We have people from Lakeshore Technical College. Would you stand? Good. Thank you for coming. And we have Green Bay, is it Preble or Preble? Preble, would you all stand, please? And your teacher, Mrs. Colette Colstead, is a graduate of our teaching institute, the Justice Teaching Institute. So thank you for all coming. It's good to see you. We also have a guest, Judge Tomohiro Nakashima. Is Judge Nakashima, won't you? And welcome to you, sir. He has been at Washington, D.C. for the year and has come to visit our court and listen to oral argument, and will meet with me and will go to the University of Wisconsin Law School's East Asian Legal Studies Center. Thank you for coming. There is material for all of you, including you, sir, about this case available in the foyer of the courtroom. And so if you don't have material about the case, that's the place to get it, and I think you'll enjoy oral argument more. With those introductions made, I'd like to introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left, Justice David Prosser, and on the far left, Justice Patience Rogensack. As part of our program for students, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and the Supreme Court, a justice will speak with the students at the end of the second oral argument, which is about 12:15. And everyone is welcome to attend that session. We discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. And I will be the justice who will handle that this noon. So with those and all the introductions made, we'll call our first case, which is 01-2710, Bonnie Pierce versus Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin. We will have the following arguments, 25 minutes by Attorney Jolene D. Schneider. We're going to have 15 minutes by George Burnett, representing Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, and 15 minutes by Michael Van Sicklin, representing the Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin and the physician, and then 5 minutes rebuttal by Ms. Schneider. Do I have the lineup correct? If so, we shall proceed. Jolene Schneider.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Jolene Schneider, and I represent Bonnie Pierce. Bonnie, an obstetrical patient, walked into the hospital on November 18, 1996, pregnant, expecting to deliver a healthy baby girl and bring her home a few days later. Unfortunately, due to admitted medical negligence, she left the hospital with a corpse, needing to plan a funeral and a life without her daughter. Bonnie suffered severe emotional injury when she was suddenly awakened in her hospital room, informed that her baby had no heartbeat, and then subjected to the agony of her baby being pulled from her body by a vacuum extractor. Today, we're asking the court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and remand the case for trial. There are two main reasons that reversal is warranted. First, Chapter 655 specifically authorizes the recovery of patients for emotional distress damages sustained as part of the medical negligence perpetrated upon her. And second, Bonnie Pierce satisfies the common law requirements for recovery of emotional injury.
Counselor, I have a little question about that. The emotional distress that she suffered because her child died instead of being able to bring the child home, I thought she was compensated for, and that this is a separate type of emotional distress that she sustained as a bystander to the death and delivery of her stillborn child. Is that right or is that not right?
This is not a derivative claim. This is not like the claim for loss of society and companionship.
Right. I'm not trying to get you into that area of discussion. I'm just trying to look at the facts. And are you claiming two types of injury for emotional distress? One, because of the loss of the child, and the second, because of the being involved in the death of the child with watching the monitor and having the child stillborn extracted. Does she have one damage for emotional distress, or does she have two?
She has one claim for all of the emotional injury that she sustained as an obstetrical patient. As an obstetrical patient, it is extremely difficult to separate out injuries that are sustained by the pregnant mother versus injuries that are sustained by the fetus. This is part of her entire experience.
Okay, so she has not been paid anything for her emotional distress in this case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and so you're not really trying to have us separate out a separate claim, but this is just an element that might expand the damages that would be awarded for emotional distress due to the whole circumstances that occurred?
This is an element of damage that we believe is clearly allowed under Chapter 655 and would not represent an expansion of the currently existing law.
Well, let me put it another way. You have settled with one or more of the defendants for medical malpractice relating to her as a patient, right?
We settled with the defendants regarding the death claim of the child.
Ah, that's what we're asking. You settled on the death claim of the child.
Correct.
What about the mother? Was there any medical malpractice relating to her for her either physical injury?
Bonnie elected to dismiss her claim for physical injury.
Okay. Did she get reimbursements of medical costs for the pregnancy and or the delivery of the stillborn?
No.
Okay. So the only claim that has been settled has been the child's claim, the wrongful death claim.
That is correct.
Okay. Then the answer, I think, to Justice Rogensack is that you have not had a claim settled for the emotional distress of the mother, regardless whether it is labeled for her treatment or the child's.
Exactly.
If I could follow up on that, and this situation is as a result of a voluntary dismissal of her own claim for medical negligence as opposed to a claim for the child's death?
That's correct. She elected not to proceed with a claim for her own physical injury and instead pursued the appeal of the dismissal of the emotional distress claim.
But had she not done that, she could have recovered a pain and suffering recovery in the context of a claim for medical negligence for herself as a patient, and that would include any mental suffering by definition, because a pain and suffering recovery includes mental suffering that she's sustained as a patient. Isn't that right?
That's true. By its very definition, pain and suffering includes mental suffering.
Right. So she voluntarily decided to forego that cause of action, which would clearly have been allowed within the context of Chapter 655.
Right. By terms of the stipulation and order that dismissed her claim and resolved the wrongful death claim, she retained the right to pursue her claim for the emotional distress damages.
As a bystander Bowen claim, But she could have recovered for her own mental suffering that surrounded this entire incident that she sustained as a patient had she pursued her own medical malpractice claim. Isn't that right?
Had she elected to proceed with her own claim, certainly she could have recovered for her physical injury.
And mental injury that she sustained as a result of what happened to her within the context of a general pain and suffering recovery, and that clearly would have been allowed by Chapter 655. Isn't that right?
Right. Only she elected not to do that, not to proceed to an expensive trial based solely upon
a
physical injury claim.
And I'm not questioning the strategic reasons why she may have done that or other reasons why she may have made that decision. But what we're talking about here is a separate tort under Bowen that she is pursuing, although it would the damages that she apparently decided to forego, mental suffering damages, is something separate that we would not be here on because they are clearly recoverable under Chapter 655. Isn't that right? I mean, had she pursued her own claim for medical malpractice, we wouldn't be here because there really is no question that her mental suffering that she sustained as a result of what happened to her in the hospital are clearly covered by Chapter 655.
But nevertheless, the fact remains that she was a patient, and 655 does allow her to recover her emotional distress injuries.
But if that's your argument, she should have pursued those emotional injuries in the context of her own claim as a patient. You're not talking about a claim as a patient. You're talking about a bystander Bowen claim, which is something entirely separate and distinct. If you're talking about her claim as a patient, that is recognized under Chapter 655, but she elected to forego that, apparently.
The problem is that Bonnie Pierce is not a bystander. She is not your classic, typical bystander, like, for example, the parents in the Finnegan case. This negligence occurred inside of Bonnie Pierce's body. One cannot get any closer to the negligence than that. This claim, in fact, presents a better Bowen claim than perhaps the Bowen case itself, because Bonnie Pierce was the mother of Brianna. Brianna was killed, and she not only witnessed but experienced a sudden traumatic event and its gruesome aftermath.
Counsel, here's the problem. Problem is that following Justice Sykes' line of questioning, her line of questioning assumes that for the medical malpractice to the mother, you can recover damages for emotional pain and suffering for the stillbirth. Mm-hmm. But didn't Judge Bayorgin say that a mother's injuries do not include the injury to or the death of a child as part of her own injuries under Kwiatkowski?
Right.
And you have made the assumption, I believe, this is the point, you've made the assumption that for her own injuries as a patient, she could not recover pain and suffering for the fact that the child was stillborn.
That's correct. I believe that the statute would allow that, but Judge Bayorgin's interpretation would not have allowed that.
Therefore, your position, if I understand it, is that she could not recover in her own action as a patient for her own injuries, emotional distress, the failure for the child being born, a stillbirth as a result of the medical malpractice. Therefore, you had to bring a separate claim for her, and you are labeling it as a patient, I understand it, for her own injuries, emotional distress as a result of the stillborn. That's your position because of Judge Bayorgin's position.
Correct.
Okay. So you're not trying for double damages.
That's correct. Absolutely not.
And you were cut out from suing as part of her own physical damage, her emotional distress for the baby.
Correct.
Therefore, you're bringing this as a separate claim, because that's what the judge said.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Sorry it took us so long.
Ms. Schneider, let me follow up on that then. My understanding is that the Court of Appeals relied heavily on the Finnegan decision coming from this court last term. How do you feel this case is different than Finnegan? What's the distinction?
This case is wholly distinct from Finnegan in that Mr. and Mrs. Finnegan, had no physician-patient relationship with the medical providers that perpetrated the negligence upon their son. Jared, the little boy in Finnegan, was gravely ill. The parents recognized that fact, and that's why they sought medical treatment. Here we have Bonnie Pierce, who has a direct physician-patient relationship with Dr. Bardazol. She has no idea or expectation in her mind that anything is wrong. A pregnant woman goes into the hospital, not because necessarily she is ill, but because she expects to walk out with a healthy baby at the end of her stay. From her perspective, she really had no idea that anything serious was wrong until that moment when she was awakened and told, "We cannot find a heartbeat for your baby." And then there was this quick chain of events whereby another nurse was called in, couldn't find a heartbeat. Went in for an ultrasound, couldn't find a heartbeat. Dr. Bardazol comes in and says, "Your baby has died. You're going to deliver her stillborn." And she's given an epidural, and the vacuum extractor is taken out, and, you know, a blue baby is pulled from her body. That is completely different from the very sad but drawn-out, attenuated circumstances of the Finnegan case, where the parents could not identify a specific sudden event that they witnessed. They witnessed a very, very long series of very sad and traumatic events for them. But, you know, they were bystanders in the very classic sense.
Well, can't the argument be made that this whole chain of events started when the monitor was flashing and the nurse said, "Oh, that's because the umbilical cord is wrapped around the child's neck"? And isn't that like 6 or 7 hours before we have this situation with the still birth of the child?
Mm-hmm. There are really two reasons why that isn't critical in this situation. One, we're here following summary judgment. There isn't any information in the record about the exact time that this child passed away. We know that the heart was beating approximately a minimum 45 minutes before Bonnie Pierce was awakened by the nurses. Because we're here on after summary judgment, we have to take those facts and construe them in the light most favorable to Bonnie Pierce. Second, Bonnie was reassured by the nurses at Theta Clark and told, "We're going to reposition you. This will solve the problem." From her perspective, that wasn't part of the sudden traumatic event. She thought everything was fine. Perhaps she was a little concerned, but assumed that the nurses knew what they were doing and that she didn't really have anything major to worry about. Second, because of her perspective, that's completely distinguishable from the situation as in Finnegan, where the parents knew that something was wrong for a long period of time. From the perspective of Bonnie Pierce, the patient, the fact that the heartbeat was lost was the sudden traumatic event. It was not any long-standing, attenuated chain of events leading up to this final moment of death.
Let me ask you something else. Are you depending on the Westcott decision?
Certainly, I think the Westcott decision is very instructive in this situation, because Westcott is part of a line of cases decided by Wisconsin appellate courts over the years trying to establish doctrines for determining authenticity of emotional distress claims. Westcott presents a factual situation extremely similar to this one. The only distinguishing factor between the Westcott case and this case is that the Westcott baby actually died during childbirth, while Bonnie Pierce's baby died in utero. The Court of Appeals in Westcott decided that Mrs. Westcott was not a bystander, that she was not a mere observer to the malpractice that occurred, that she, in fact, was a participant under the controlling test at that time, Garrett. Garrett was certainly a more restrictive test than the Bowen test. The Bowen test is seen as being a much more liberal test in terms of recovering for emotional distress damages. If you would go back and look at all the various tests that Wisconsin courts have developed over the years in trying to determine authenticity of emotional distress claims and limitations of liability, Bonnie Pierce would satisfy basically every one of those tests. She was physically injured as a result of the malpractice. She was in the zone of danger, no doubt. And under Westcott, she's not a bystander. She is a participant. She is part of the action.
Well, how do you handle the argument that Westcott has been functionally overruled, if you will, by Bowen, that Bowen said, look, we've had all of these tests in Wisconsin. We've got to make a change. We've got to agree on what the test should be. Here's the test. How do you handle that argument?
In two ways. First, although the Garrett test is no longer the controlling test, I think it remains clear that an obstetrical patient is not a mere observer of the events that happen inside of her own body and to her while she is in labor and delivery. And second, Bonnie Pierce satisfies the Bowen requirements for recovery, which are even more liberal than the Garrett requirements. She's Brianna's mother, Brianna was killed, and Bonnie Pierce experienced the most horrible thing that any obstetrical patient, any expecting mother could experience. She had a blue baby pulled from her body, and all of the hopes and dreams that go along with being a pregnant mother and expecting to have a child in your life snatched away from her in what she perceived to be a very short period of time as the result of others' negligence. If that is not a sudden traumatic event, and if experiencing a stillbirth is not a gruesome aftermath, it's difficult to imagine a situation that would be. Just because she did not visualize the umbilical cord being wrapped around Brianna's neck does not mean that she can't recover. If, for example, you look at the facts of the Bowen case, Sharon Bowen did not physically see whatever negligent acts or omissions occurred inside Mr. Routman's car before he struck her son on his bicycle. What happened was she came upon the scene and saw this terrible, terrible thing that had happened to her child. That is what happened in this case. She suddenly learned about a terrible, terrible, terrible thing that happened to her child and saw it for herself when this child was pulled from her body.
Could I ask you, suppose the father of the child had been present throughout the entire circumstances, observed the monitor, observed everything. How would you analyze the claim if it were made by the father?
Well, certainly that's not the situation we have here. I think the clearest example or the clear path to recovery is certainly through Bonnie Pierce as an obstetrical patient. The law is very clear that a patient can recover. When you have another close family member, like a father, who is observing what is occurring, that person is a bystander in the classic sense. I do think that in that situation, the father would satisfy the requirements under Bowen, because he would be related to the baby as a father, the baby would have died, And assuming the facts that you've put forth, he too would have experienced or witnessed what he perceived to be a sudden traumatic event.
Are there any limitations on damages for negligent infliction of emotional distress?
Oh, absolutely. If it's brought as a Chapter 655 action, Section 893.55 clearly provides for limitation of damages. And that limitation of damages is just one of the ways in which there is a safeguard against limitless liability. There's a safeguard against runaway medical malpractice premiums and the fear expressed in one of the amicus briefs that doctors would be going out of business. The legislature was very deliberate in creating a system that limited the class of claimants who could bring claims in 655.007, established the mediation system so that claims would be disposed of perhaps in that manner rather than going to litigation. We have limitations on the types of damages. We have caps on the amount of damages. We have a ban on punitive damages. All of those things operating together limit recovery and guard against the fears expressed by some of the defendants and by the amicus brief that this will result in just runaway litigation.
If the court should hold that the mother here is a participant, she is the patient, and her damages for medical malpractice include emotional distress for the child. That's what you want us to hold, right?
Correct. We want you to hold that she, as a patient, can recover for all the emotional injury that she sustains as part of her experience.
Okay, and I'm going to go back to the questions that started with Justice Robinsack through me and Justice Sykes. How does that fit with Judge Bayorgen's decision? And how does that fit with your stipulation of what was dismissed? Because you dismissed the mother's claim for her own emotional distress as a result of her own treatment, right? So I'm just trying to see where it all fits. That's my problem. Or to put it another way, does this review include a review of Judge Bayorgen's holding that there's a dismissal of her claim for the emotional distress as a bystander, but she can only claim for her own personal injury? I'm still having trouble with that.
Judge Bayorgen's decision would not have permitted Bonnie Pierce to recover emotional distress damages for anything other than the direct physical injury to her.
And I think the question that's being asked is maybe that's the problem with this case, was the restrictive nature of the definition of the recovery of the pain and suffering emotional distress
yes.
damages of the patient, the mother, rather than whether or not there should or should be a separate Bowen claim, which is an independent tort.
Mm-hmm. The further question is whether or not your stipulation on getting here knocked out that claim.
Even if that were the case, we still believe that Bonnie Pierce could pursue this claim as a separate tort. There have been instances in the past where this court has held that Chapter 655 is not the exclusive remedy for medical malpractice claims. And I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. We will now hear from George Burnett, representing the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
May it please the court. Mr. Van Sicklin and I have agreed to divide responsibility in today's argument between two issues. I will be addressing the issue of whether or not Chapter 655 allows or precludes this claim, and Mr. Van Sicklin will be addressing the issue of whether or not Bowen and Finnegan somehow or other bar or allow this claim. We recognize that there's some overlap between the two issues, and both are prepared to address questions from the court on that subject. But before I begin to address the subject that I'm prepared to talk about today, I think it's important to address Justice Rogensack's question that prefaced this this argument. I think that there are four psychic damages that are potentially at play here. They would be a mother's grief for losing her child, and traditionally under the common law, that is not an element of damages. That's in the jury instruction on wrongful death. The second is the loss of the society and companionship of that child, the type of things that when we argue to a jury, we talk about a mother seeing her daughter on her wedding day, that the lifetime of experience that a mother or father gains from their child, their joy. That case has been settled. The third element component of damages is the emotional distress that's incumbent with a Bowen claim. The shock and the horror of entering upon a traumatic accident scene to see your child beneath the wheels of a car. That's Bowen. This court held in Finnegan that the shock and the horror of carrying your child in an elevator for medical care was outside Bowen in Finnegan. And then the last component of psychic damages is Bonnie Pierce's own physical pain and suffering. If there was any additional pain and suffering because of this medical malpractice action, because childbirth is by nature a painful experience, her own pain and suffering that would be the consequence of her being malpracticed upon. If there is no proof of that in this record, but if there was, it was the subject of dismissal by that stipulation.
Okay, so you're saying that under the common law, under her own medical malpractice claim, she would not be entitled to grief as a result of the stillborn.
That's right. That's in the jury instruction.
So the assumption of all of our questioning that Bay Origin was incorrect is incorrect in your view.
I think Judge Bay Origin was correct in what.
And so your position, which may or may not be accepted by the court, of course, your position is that the only way you can recover in Wisconsin for emotional distress of the death of a child, and the death of a child here, would be under Bowen as a bystander, not under her own patient's claim for medical malpractice.
That's right. And that's Chapter 655, the argument that I'm prepared to address today.
Before you move on to that, is there any case law that addresses the scope of a pain and suffering recovery in the case of an obstetrical patient and whether that covers or encompasses
the
pregnancy as well as the mother's own physical well-being and mental distress associated with that?
I think I see what you're asking, but I haven't read the Sipes cases in a long enough period of time, and I'm reluctant to enter into what I regard as a very confusing area of the law on that issue without being prepared for it. But I think that a mother or any patient's pain and suffering, which is enhanced by medical malpractice, is a common component of any damages for pain and suffering, and I've never seen anyone argue to the contrary. I don't know if that addresses the question.
Mr. Burnett, as I understand it, you're taking the position that Chapter 655 does not allow for such a claim. Is that correct?
That's right.
Was the Westcott decision decided when 655 was in place?
I think the Westcott decision, and I looked at this when writing the Court of Appeals brief, but I think the Westcott decision and 655 came very closely together.
I think Westcott's 1988.
Yeah.
And they've got to be about the same time.
So right.
What, is there anything you can point to that would show some kind of change in the enactment of 655 that was aimed at the Westcott decision?
No, I don't know, and I have a feeling that the Westcott decision and 655 were proceeding down parallel tracks. I think that's significant because Westcott never talks about 655, and I don't think it provides the court much guidance at all as to whether that statute covers the situation or not.
But what is it in Chapter 655 that you think stops now an action such as this?
There's Chapter 655, and there's a long line of cases from this court that indicate that it is the exclusive procedure and remedy in medical malpractice cases. 655-007 and 655-005 both speak to this issue. .655-005 says any person listed in 007 having a claim or derivative claim against a health care provider for damages for bodily injury due to the acts or omissions is subject to this chapter. 007 says any patient or patient's representative having a claim or any spouse, parent, minor sibling, or child of the patient having a derivative claim for injury or death on account of medical malpractice is subject to this chapter. I think the key words there are is subject to this chapter. And what the court has focused on in the past is that language in determining that those three words confine a patient or a derivative claim to 655.
And does Westcott fall within patient? The Westcott decision says the person is a participant, right?
Right.
So then if you want to get it within 655, say the Westcott decision falls within 655, and therefore this case falls within 655, then you have to say participant equals patient.
Well, I would disagree.
Okay.
And the reason I would disagree is this, that in this situation, Bonnie Pierce really falls in one of these two categories in the language doesn't tell this court which category to place this person.
And where would you place her in accordance with the Westcott decision?
I would place her in the parent category for the simple reason.
Derivative action.
I think it's an independent action.
Okay.
But
all right. So she's not in any of those categories.
She's not in either
of
those
view.
Categories for the same reasons that this court expressed in Finnegan.
Why can't you say she's a patient under Westcott?
Because
the participant.
Well, I think for two reasons. First of all, the participant bystander scenario has been overruled by Bowen.
Well, you can argue that the participant doesn't fall within bystander. That's why it didn't come within the regular rules then of bystander. You say it's a participant, you fall into regular tort law.
As I read this court's decision in Bowen, what this court did in Bowen is it looked at what I think are some very troubling decisions going back a long period of time. A mother in Wabi versus Warrington looking out a picture window.
It's definitely a bystander. She's not a participant.
What this court did in Bowen is to jettison that entire analysis.
Bystander analysis, right.
The decision as to whether or not this person is a parent or a patient really looks to the essence of Bowen. The essence of Bowen is a close familial relationship between the victim and the observer, whether the observer is very close, like a patient, or further away, like a mother looking out the window as her child crosses a busy highway. That those are the kind of distinctions that I think this court tried to get away from in Bowen, because the court recognized that decades of making those distinctions created a jurisprudence that was very difficult for the courts and the litigants to follow. So I would think that based on Bowen, based on Finnegan, based on 655, that these kinds of distinctions are something to be avoided.
So your position is she's neither a patient for this emotional distress argument, nor is it a derivative action. It's independent, as Justice Sykes wrote in Finnegan.
Yes.
Where do you get the authority for saying that somebody who is not a patient and not a derivative action is subject to 655? What you read us says X is subject to 655, Y is subject to 655, and they're governed by the statute. Where do you have, like in workers' comp, a section in the code that says this is the exclusive remedy for anybody injured by medical malpractice?
Three cases.
You got the three cases, but none of them are exactly like this.
Well, one of them is, I'd say, exactly like this, and that's Sapansky, which is this court's decision dealing with whether or not adult children can sue for wrongful death. This court analyzed 655.007, and it said that adult children cannot sue for wrongful death because they aren't listed in that statute.
That's a derivative action?
Pardon?
Derivative wrongful death derivative, question mark, or independent?
Wrongful death would be a derivative action.
Okay.
But that's not what this court explained its interpretation of the statute was in Sapansky. In Sapansky, this court said because the words adult child are missing, only minor child appears, therefore 655 doesn't apply because 655 is the exclusive remedy and procedure. There is no such claim because the legislature didn't create one.
Are you referring to Nierengarten instead of Sapansky?
I thought the adult claim was Sapansky. Let me...
Well, whichever it is.
That's okay. We can clarify that ourselves.
Yeah, we can check that out, Mr. Burnett. That's fine.
236 was second, 316.
That was a Bowen claim, too, was it not, for negligent infliction of emotional distress?
I don't remember if it was Bowen or not. I don't think I saw Bowen expressly imagined in or talked about in that statute. But if I could just address Justice Prosser's question very briefly about where this all is going. There is a case, another tort reform case called Blaskovic versus City of Milwaukee. The court construed insurance coverage issues there. And what the court said is it said, faced with an argument that the policy there, the drive other car exclusion of the policy there was one of many policies of many clauses allowed by statute, the court said there would be no reason to enact a statute such as 632.32 in that case if you intended to sanction a particular clause. The only thing that the legislature could have done is it intended to outlaw other drive other car exclusions. That same argument applies here. The real danger in advancing down the road that the plaintiffs are urging, and I see my time is growing short, is this, that we are embarking on a decade of litigation. There is a real economic and strategic incentive in trying to place malpractice claims in the independent category as opposed to the derivative category. What caps apply, even in this case, is not clear. We have two statutes, 895.55-4B, which talks about a cap for non-economic damages, and 3.554F, which talks about wrongful death damages. If this claim is derivative, as the plaintiffs are have suggested in one part of their brief, then the caps have covered it. The monies that were paid to settle the wrongful death claim have covered it. If this claim is independent, then is there a cap? Is that truly what the legislature intended, to create a second solar system of medical malpractice claims so that litigants can quarrel about whether the collateral source rule applies or whether – I see my time is up. Thank you.
You may finish the sentence, sir.
Or whether the adult children can sue for wrongful death outside of 655 for uncapped damages when minor children are capped, whether mediation is the statute of limitations, whether the fund covers independent physicians on these claims, whether or not there are punitive damages. We are being urged to enter into a course of litigation that truly has, I fear, no sensible stopping point. And the message that we're giving the legislature when it writes a statute is that unless the legislature expressly abolishes every possible cause of action, there exists an independent claim outside the statute the legislature passed. Thank you.
Mr. Burnett, before you sit down, I'd just like to clarify something you just said. You said if this action were found to be derivative, that the caps have covered it here. Do you mean by that the settlement that was reached is something that would be stopped by any increase in this action? In other words, that what's been paid meets the caps and you can't go beyond it?
Yes, I do. It's sub F says, notwithstanding the limits on non-economic damages under this section, damages recoverable against a healthcare provider for wrongful death are subject to the limit under 895.04. Well, if this is a derivative claim for wrongful death, the caps have the plaintiffs have recovered all that they are entitled to.
Caps have been satisfied.
That's right.
Words. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's a good question.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Mike Van Sicklin. It's my pleasure to team with Mr. Burnett. I represent defendant respondents, Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin, and its insured, Dr. Bardazol. I'm going to focus just on the second question, which received a lot of questioning earlier, namely whether the Court of Appeals was correct in its unanimous decision that Ms. Pierce's bystander claim for emotional distress damages fails as a matter of law under this Court's unanimous decision in Bowen as applied and affirmed last term in Finnegan. Both, it's important to note at the outset, both of these issues fit together and have a consistent answer. For Ms. Pierce's claim to survive, she needs to overcome both of the hurdles, both that this claim is not barred by Chapter 655, and additionally, even if it's not barred, that she satisfies Bowen and Finnegan. And we submit that she fails both of those tests. And that the consistent answer is these types of emotional distress bystander claims are inappropriate in the medical malpractice context. I'm going to reverse the order of my argument here and focus first on what I think the six main arguments are that Ms. Pierce has advanced to try to distinguish her case from Bowen and Finnegan and react to some of the questions that you posed earlier this morning. And if time permits, come back to why I think the Court of Appeals is correct in its application of Finnegan to this particular case. The first argument that is their primary argument in both Ms. Pierce's brief and in the amicus brief filed on her behalf by the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers is that this is a fact issue, this application of the three-part Bowen test, and that it was a mistake for both the trial court and the Court of Appeals to decide it on summary judgment. That's simply wrong. They're misapprehending that under Bowen there's two types of tests. There's a multi-part criteria for proving causation, which is admittedly fact-based. There's a separate three-part policy test, which this Court expressly held in three different places in Bowen and reaffirmed in Finnegan, is a question of law for decision by this court. So whether or not Ms. Pierce's claim satisfies the third prong of the Bowen test is appropriate for summary judgment and a decision as a matter of law by this court. The second issue really is the one that was the focus of your arguments, and that is we think the confusion that's been throughout Ms. Pierce's arguments from the trial court to the Court of Appeals to this morning, the confusion between the two different claims and the two different events. The claim for being a bystander witness to the death of her child, and we believe the separate and different claim as a patient for her own emotional distress from the stillbirth process. And it's important to note, again, as you picked up on, that the latter claim, her claim as a patient for any kind of pain or injury associated with the delivery process and any kind of emotional distress she had as a patient, was expressly waived by stipulation. She got paid money as part of the compromise to waive that and every other claim in this case other than the very narrow claim that the trial judge directly decided against her on summary judgment. That is whether she has a Bowen bystander claim for witnessing the death of her child. It has nothing to do with the later delivery in which she was a patient and claims she...
Would that category of damages on her part as a patient include pain and suffering, including mental anguish associated with the stillbirth process?
Yes, if she had emotional distress from her own treatment as a patient in that delivery process. But I think it's important to note here that she tries to claim in her briefs that there was something gruesome about, to use the Bowen term, about the stillbirth process. But the problem with her claim in that regard is it's very attenuated in time, which is something that this court focused on in Finnegan. We have a series of events here where she knows for over an hour that her baby is dead in utero. It's explained to her by Dr. Bartizol that this tragedy has occurred, your baby is dead, we're going to have to schedule a delivery to deliver the child by stillbirth. That occurs at least an hour later, and it's not something that's a surprise or a shocking traumatic event, nor is it something that is gruesome in the sense of the Bowen case law or Finnegan, in the sense that the baby was not, you know, disfigured by the process of the stillbirth delivery. In fact, Ms. Pierce took the baby with her back to her room for 10 hours, invited friends and family to share her moment of grief with her. She went out, or her fiancé, to the car and got a camera and took photos together with the baby. This is not the sort of activity, while tragic, that satisfies this court's analysis of a gruesome event that's sudden and unexpected.
Let's assume an auto accident in which mom and child are in the car together and are transported to the hospital together and are in the emergency room together in adjacent beds being worked on by medical personnel. And let's assume an act of medical malpractice on mom and child in the course of that emergency room treatment, and let's also assume that mom witnesses the act of medical malpractice on the child and that it's really bad, without conjuring up some detail of that. Would that satisfy Bowen?
I think there are possibly situations where you can have medical negligence that is not so attenuated in time. As this court emphasized in Finnegan, you need to focus on what is the injury-producing event. The injury-producing event in a malpractice case is the medical negligence. In our situation, that occurred over a long period of time with Dr. Bartizol and was very attenuated from any later death of the child and the even more subsequent 8 or 9 hours later stillbirth delivery. In your hypothetical, what you're trying to do is collapse that time so it's not attenuated. And if you immediately witness a sudden injury, you know, producing event, malpractice, it has a very sudden, within moments, or contemporaneous reaction that's horrifying and shocking, yes, I think you could theoretically satisfy the third prong of the Bowen test. But your example, I think, highlights the flaw in Ms. Pierce's case here, is that this baby died sometime in her sleep. She testified unequivocally as part of the summary judgment record that she felt no pain, no discomfort at any time during the 6 hours or so between when Dr. Bartizol and the nurse last visited her and when she awoke to find that the baby was dead within her in utero. At no point did she have any pain or discomfort or any sense of the baby having been in pain or discomfort. And then she was told it's dead and we're going to schedule the delivery at a subsequent time. That's a far cry from the situation that you hypothesized. She tries to get around that flaw in her argument by saying, well, even though Bowen requires a direct sensory perception that's immediate, not attenuated in time, and even though I didn't have that direct sensory perception, obviously I didn't witness the baby dying in utero, I couldn't see it, I didn't feel it, she says I have an experiential perception, some kind of a subliminal, subconscious perception of the baby's struggles. And I submit that that's the wrong path for this court to go down for a lot of reasons. One is it's directly contrary to the holding in Bowen that you have to have a direct personal sensory perception, seeing it, hearing it, sensing it, not something that's subliminal. Secondly, this court's, all of its decisions, including Bowen, reflect very strong judicial skepticism to vague, hard-to-test emotional distress claims. If you recognize some kind of a test that's impossible to evaluate for experiential perceptions, there'll be no end of these types of claims. And then finally, the problem with that is that it's contrary to the record here. There's nothing in her affidavits in opposition to summary judgment or in her deposition testimony or in her own five-page handwritten notes of what happened here that gives any suggestion of experiential perceptions of pain about the baby. This is just an argument made up for purposes of the appellate argument.
Counsel, are you finished with that point?
I am, yes.
Okay. It causes me pause that we are here in part because the trial court said that you can only pursue a bystander claim. That's what I understand the trial court's holding to be. Is that correct?
No, I think that's incorrect. I think it's sort of just a flip of that. She pled in sort of vague terms that she, as a patient, encountered emotional distress from the stillbirth delivery process. And that separate and apart from that, that she suffered emotional distress as a bystander, as a parent, because her child died. What the trial court did was reject on summary judgment the latter claim, the bystander claim for witnessing the death of the child, and said, you may still pursue your own emotional distress claim as a patient for the stillbirth delivery process. She chose then to settle everything to receive the maximum amount from the defendants on the wrongful death claim, and in return dismissed with prejudice her own emotional distress claim.
Let me, if I may, take the last few sentences prior to the conclusion of the judge's opinion. He says, however, the plaintiff, I'm reading from page 4 of his opinion, I guess, appendix 21 of the blue brief, however, the plaintiff can only recover the emotional pain and suffering which resulted from her own injuries caused by the medical malpractice. I'm going to pause. I don't know if you're on the same page.
I have it right here, Your Honor.
Okay, good. Then, she can only recover for that, her own emotional pain and suffering. The next sentence, a mother's injuries do not include the injury to or death of a child as part of her own injuries. And then it says, see Kwiatkowski. I'm not sure what that sentence means. Does that sentence mean that a mother is precluded from claiming as part of her own injuries, observing her observation and pain and suffering that comes from that observation? Or does that mean that a mother's injuries do not include the injury to a child? I mean, you know, obviously she can't claim the child's injury. What is it? I haven't read recently Kwiatkowski. It's a C. Kwiatkowski. What is it?
Basically, as I understand it, Your Honor, it's settled law reflected in our jury instructions based on this case and others that to the extent a child has its own injuries, a young child, and the child dies, say, the estate has that claim for those injuries. The mother doesn't have a duplicative claim for that. What the judge goes on in the next sentence is, and talks about that the mother plaintiff may seek relief for the emotional distress connected to her own injuries, but she may not seek relief for the emotional distress associated with the injuries and death of her stillborn infant.
And I don't know really what that means, because one view of it is she is not claiming the relief for the, she's not claiming relief for the child's injuries qua child's injuries. Arguably, she's claiming relief for the emotional distress of to her and what was transpiring to the child. I mean, we have kind of unique facts because it's birth.
I think it's the nature of the claim being quite different. I mean, the issue is not the extent of the parent's grief. I mean, the loss of society and companionship is a different claim, and that's the wrongful death claim. The issue of a bystander claim is you need something additional. It's whether the parent suffered from some severe emotional distress from a sudden contemporaneous witnessing of a shocking, gruesome, traumatic event.
I don't understand why this is necessarily a bystander.
Before you answer that, I have it written down, which may be wrong, in which in your second point you said, if the mother suffered emotional distress because of the child being born stillborn, she would have recovered for that emotional distress, but it was waived in the stipulation. And it sounded to me as that was contrary to what Mr. Burnett said.
No, I don't. If I said that, I misspoke. That's not what I thought I said, Your Honor. What is the witnessing is of the injury or death to the child. It's not from her own pain or suffering from the as a patient from the process. She had no claim of injury as a patient. There was nothing negligent about the delivery process. And she did not witness anything about the child suffering. The child, while she slept, died in the mother's sleep here. And so the question is, you cannot, under this court's analysis in Finnegan, find that she witnessed anything in a direct, personal, sensory fashion from a child that dies in utero.
The problem here is that child is in utero. That is part of her body at that time. Something has been done to her. What was the malpractice here?
Well, it's vaguely stipulated. It's a mismanagement of the labor that led to the child's
death.
Okay.
It's a mismanagement of the labor. And who is in labor? The mother. Mother's labor has been mismanaged. As a result of that mismanagement, she has not delivered a live child. This is all part of her. It goes back to the issue of what can she recover for mismanaging her body to produce a stillborn child. You say she cannot recover for her grief for the stillborn because she recovers for that under wrongful death. Is that your position?
There's very different claims, Your Honor, I think. There's the bystander claim.
I'm not into bystander anymore. For this moment, I am into her claim for her damages as a result of medical malpractice to her.
If she had not stipulated and dismissed those claims, she could have tried to prove up that she had some kind of separate and different emotional distress, although it would be inconsistent with the fact record in this particular case.
Okay, that's what I'm driving at. What kind of separate and different emotional distress could she have proved up that she could recover in Med-Mal?
I believe it would be very difficult because it would be so attenuated in time from the injury-producing event. But if you say we're not going to look at this at all as a bystander claim, we're going to look at her separate claim purely as a mother in this birthing process, I think it would be a whole different set of factual proof that you would have to advance.
Just a minute. That assumes that the pain and suffering that is sustained by an obstetrical patient who is the victim of medical malpractice is the same as the pain and suffering that is sustained by a non-obstetrical patient who is the victim of medical malpractice. And that, I'm not sure, is...
But the only pain here suffered by Ms. Pierce, by her own stipulation, was just through the delivery process, which she acknowledged was no different or greater in a pain sense than a normal delivery. It's only the, if she had some additional emotional distress.
I understand the stipulation here, but for the stipulation, in a hypothetical case, an obstetrical patient could attempt to prove that her own pain and suffering and mental anguish associated with the medical malpractice included fear for the loss of the child and recover that within the confines of Chapter 655 and a pain and suffering recovery, which would then be subject to the caps? Is that not legally sustainable?
No, I think that's what the trial court said, that she could have proceeded but chose not to. But here there was no... It would be very difficult, I submit, for her to establish emotional distress from the stillbirth because she knew about it well in advance. It was not a surprise or a shock that the baby was delivered stillborn. She had known that that was the tragic, unfortunate result of the baby having died in utero.
Counselor, can I give you another hypothetical? Let's say the diagnosis is cancer of the bone in the lower leg, and the doctor says the only treatment we have for you is to cut off your lower leg, and this is a young person who has a long time to live, and they consult with their doctor and they decide to have the lower leg cut off. But once the leg is gone and there's been further tests on the bone, it's determined that, by darn, it really wasn't cancer of the leg, and we didn't have to cut off the leg. Now, certainly that would be malpractice. Isn't there a recovery there for the emotional pain and suffering of losing a leg you didn't have to lose?
Sure. I mean,
Well, how is that? I don't see how that's any different from allowing her the recovery for emotional pain and suffering because of a botched delivery.
Well, certainly the law...
I don't think you have to have physical overwhelming pain to have extreme emotional pain.
Certainly the law permits recovery of non-economic damages from malpractice.
Right.
And there's obviously a different test for a bystander seeking those types of damages from a participant.
But I'm not worried about the bystander.
If you're the patient in your example and you've lost your leg by a mistake, you have the right to seek recovery from it.
I have a right to receive recovery for my emotional pain and suffering due to the fact that I no longer have a leg, right?
As in any normal malpractice case,
okay.
Yes.
Then why doesn't she have the right to seek damages for emotional pain and suffering because she doesn't have a child?
Well, again, you have to avoid the overlap of loss of society and consortium that's covered by her wrongful death claim. But if she can establish a separate category of non-economic damages for some kind of shock or emotional distress, I think that would be potentially a viable claim.
But that's the claim that was stipulated away?
Correct.
Right.
That's what we're having trouble with.
Where's the stipulation in the record that was stipulated away?
It's a series of documents, Your Honor, and if you look at, first you have the decision by the trial court in which the judge makes this dichotomy between the two emotional distress claims. You then have two stipulations, and one is record number 65, which is the stipulation where the defendants stipulate to the negligence and stipulate to pay the maximum for the economic damages and the wrongful death claim. And then you have the related stipulation for dismissal, which is record number 66, wherein the parties stipulate that the amended complaint of plaintiff and all of the causes of action set forth therein, with the exception of the cause of action which was dismissed by the court by order dated August 2001, may be dismissed upon the merits, with prejudice, etc. That's the stipulation that dismissed every claim she had other than the one that the trial court denied on summary judgment.
And
Record 66.
And what language are you pointing to in the trial court's denial of summary judgment to indicate that this is the claim that still lives? What words are you pointing to?
I believe, Your Honor, it's what you and I just read out loud a few minutes ago. Plus, there's an order that basically adopts that same language from the decision.
Here's what was dismissed. I'm looking at Plaintiff's Appendix 17. That's the blue brief. It's ordered that defendant's motion for partial summary judgment seeking to dismiss plaintiff's claim for damages negligently inflicted emotional distress is hereby granted in part. Which part was that? Plaintiff's claim for damages for negligently inflicted emotional distress arising from the injuries and stillbirth of a daughter is dismissed. And plaintiff is precluded from presenting evidence of damages for emotional distress arising out of injuries and stillbirth. Those were the ones that are dismissed. They are the ones that are before this court. Is that right?
Only thing before the court is the bystander claim. Everything else was dismissed.
I don't see bystander mentioned in Bayorgin's order.
Well, I don't think he uses the word bystander.
That's right. He is using the words her negligently inflicted emotional distress on her. And we agree that if it were a leg, she could recover for negligently inflicted emotional distress, right?
If she could sustain all the normal requirements of causation.
And that's not a bystander claim. That's right. Okay, so we don't know from this what it is. Now, there's a stipulation at page 13, labeled Exhibit A. Is that either Record 65 or 66?
Record item 66 is the one-paragraph stipulation.
Okay, that's not it. Mm-hmm.
And then record item 65 is the longer stipulation that includes the negligence and wrongful death award.
Okay, and that's it. So she collectively agreed to pay loss of society and companionship, $150,000 statutory limits, plus funeral expenses. So is that the statutory limit that Mr. Burnett was referring to when he said she got statutory limits?
As Your Honor knows, yes, the cap on the wrongful death amounts has changed over time you dealt with the Schultz. And
so is that her total recovery, $150,000 for the loss of society? Was there any other
plus
payments?
A small amount for the funeral expenses,
right,
et cetera.
Any other payments?
No.
Okay.
I'm way out of time, but I'm happy to keep answering questions. I don't want to have an unfair advantage here over a plaintiff.
Don't worry about it, counsel. All right. Thank you. Okay. Ms. Schneider.
There are a few responsive points that I want to make in response to what's been said by Mr. Burnett and Mr. Van Sicklen. First, it is completely inconsistent with the precedent to suggest that Bonnie Pierce was a mere observer who stood by and watched this terrible event happen to her. Westcott was decided when Chapter 655 was in place. The legislature, since that time, has elected not to modify 655 in any manner, which would change the underpinning of Westcott, which is that an obstetrical patient is not a bystander to medical negligence that occurs during childbirth. It's been suggested that perhaps the stillbirth was not a gruesome event. First, the record is somewhat undeveloped on this issue. Again, we're here following summary judgment. We must take the facts and assume that they are presented in a way that is most favorable to Bonnie Pierce. Losing a child and seeing that child pulled from your body, blue and lifeless, would most certainly be gruesome. To say that it is not a gruesome thing for a mother to behold and experience is almost insulting.
I have no trouble
agreeing with that, but that's her claim as an obstetrical patient whose child has been lost by an act of medical malpractice, not as a Bowen bystander claim.
Yes.
And this is interrelated with what we have been struggling with all morning, is how to categorize this claim. If you're making a Bowen bystander claim, because she was a bystander and satisfies the Bowen requirements as such, then you're out of Chapter 655, at least according to my lead opinion in Finnegan. If you're making a claim on your client's part as the patient for stillbirth that she experienced as an obstetrical patient, then it's, you know, part of her pain and suffering recovery, but you stipulated that away.
The problem was that Judge Bayorgen's decision effectively precluded her from making a claim as a patient for any of her emotional distress arising from that stillbirth experience.
Well, and that's why I asked the question earlier in your argument about whether that's the real problem here, his inappropriate circumscription of or restrictions on her pain and suffering recovery as a patient for the mental anguish that an obstetrical patient experiences during the course of a stillbirth delivery.
Certainly, from our perspective, Judge Bayorgen's decision did present a real problem. And Judge Bayorgen never addressed in his decision or at any other point on the record whether or not Bonnie Pierce was a bystander, did not address Bowen, did not address any of these other factors. It's our position that 655 controls this claim and allows Bonnie Pierce to recover. It is also our position that if the court chooses to impose the Bowen requirements within Chapter 655, that Bonnie Pierce meets those requirements.
How do you overcome your stipulation? Let us just say 655 controls. She is a patient. This is her claim. She gets a claim for emotional distress caused by the stillbirth. How do you overcome your stipulation? I mean, why can't we say, you're absolutely right, legal theory, counsel, but you have waived that because you stipulated, and that's the end of your case. How do we overcome that? Maybe we can't.
Well, here's the answer to that. Okay. The judge's order, and I'm sorry, I don't have the record reference numbers. It's in the appendix to our brief on page 12. It is ordered that the amended complaint and all of the causes of action set forth therein, with the exception of those causes of action that were dismissed by the court pursuant to the court's order of August 20th, 2001, is hereby dismissed.
Right. And then you're saying your claim there was for her both as a bystander and as the patient. Is that your argument?
The judge's decision precluded Bonnie Pierce from recovering for any emotional distress related to the stillbirth, whether that occurred as a patient or as a bystander.
Right.
Therefore, there was really nothing left as a practical matter after the judge's decision for her to pursue.
Do we have one patient or two here?
Well, it's interesting. I believe, as a technical matter, when an obstetrical patient goes into the hospital, she's the patient until the baby is actually born, and then the mother and the baby are patients. There's really no information in the record that I can specifically point to about that, but I believe that is the case. I believe until the baby is born, the mother is the registered patient.
Did the baby recover for any pain and suffering prior to birth? No.
There's no claim made for that.
So the only claim that you recovered on was for loss of society. That's for the
funeral
mother
expenses.
And the funeral expenses.
To the extent we were to say that the pain and suffering of an obstetrical patient in a stillbirth situation caused by medical malpractice encompasses anguish associated with the stillbirth of the child, are you at the damage cap for purposes of the non-economic damages?
No. Absolutely. Those would be non-economic damages under 893.55, subject to the limit, the index, which I believe is now around $400,000. It is not the same as the loss of society and companionship claim, the death claim, which is capped at $150,000. Completely different types of damage. Her emotional distress claim arising from the stillbirth experience is completely different from the loss of that ongoing relationship with her child.
Well, that's why I asked the one patient or two question, because it's my understanding, and perhaps this is wrong, but that they're all lumped together for purposes of a non-economic damages cap. And if you consider this a one-patient situation as opposed to a two-patient situation, you may be capped. Would that not be the case or no?
I don't believe that's the case. Although the mother is the patient when she's admitted into the hospital, precedent holds, and I'm sorry I am out of time.
Get the same fair share of answering questions.
Thank you. The Kwiatkowski case that was referenced earlier in the argument was a car accident case in which I believe the mother's injuries resulted in a stillbirth of her child. And the court then held that the fetus is a separate person under Wisconsin law and that there is a wrongful death claim for that child, which is why we had the wrongful death claim for Brianna in this case. And so I believe at that point, once the stillbirth occurs, there are two separate individuals.
Chief, may I? In part, I think that gets to the heart of the problem here, because you've got to trace the language from what was settled, and we just looked at that, and then you got to look at what was dismissed by the court, because what was not settled was what was dismissed. You look at the court's decision, and it cites Kwiatkowski for the premise that a mother's injuries do not include, page 4 of the decision, a mother's injuries do not include the injury to or death of a child as part of her own injuries, and citing Kwiatkowski. And then the judge takes that sort of cite to Kwiatkowski, which seems to be a little bit different because it was the wrongful death claim, and then translates that, which is the sentence in the order, to the sentence in the decision, to the order on page 17 of the appendix. The plaintiff is precluded from presenting evidence of damages for emotional distress arising out of the injuries and stillbirth of her daughter. My question is this. Does Kwiatkowski stand for this premise that it's cited for as, see Kwiatkowski, a mother's injuries do not include the injury to or death of a child as part of her own injuries? Should that be interpreted to mean that a mother who's giving birth cannot include, as part of her own injuries, the pain and suffering that we have as the facts here?
I will admit that it's been some time since I actually read the Kwiatkowski decision, but I believe the central issue in that case was whether or not there could be a wrongful death claim made on behalf of or for the death of the deceased child. That independent emotional distress suffered by the mother as a result of that experience was not part of what was claimed in that case. Therefore, I don't believe that Judge Bayorjan is correct in his decision when he says that a mother's injuries cannot include damage relating to what in this case would really be the experience that she had. It's not distress over the child being stillborn per se. It's the experience that she had and what she witnessed and went through. The shock and grief and horror that she experienced is what she is seeking to recover for here. It's not about the loss of society and companionship.
So isn't that injury similar to the one that I used in my example when the patient's leg is cut off unnecessarily? The injury-causing event is malpractice, but the emotional injury is for what she went through because of the malpractice.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, I want to thank attorneys Schneider, Burnett, and Van Sicklen for a very interesting argument relating to medical malpractice and bystander damages. And I want to congratulate all of you for presenting an excellent case. That concludes our hearing in 01-2710, Pierce versus Physician Insurance Company of Wisconsin et al. The court will take a few moments recess so the students who wish to leave may do so, and other students may enter the courtroom. We're in recess for a few moments.
Julian.
Nice job.
Nice to meet you.